This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Steve Coxhead. He's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. We'll take up the issue of rail safety, and particularly in light of all of the accidents involving freight passenger trains, that is, and some freight trains, for that matter. We'll also get an update, too, on the Amtrak Hoosier State and Cardinal service and how things are going with that lately. We'll also have a conversation, of course, with a fellow from Booking.com. Shay Moody will tell us about an interesting B&B that has been set up in Lowell and is on the big list this year. You can check that out and maybe even go on the website and reserve space. And then, of course, it's Green Fleet Radio with Carl Lissick coming up. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. As the weather gets better, we find more people traveling. In particular, they're starting to pick up on the rail services in Northwest Indiana. Let's find out the latest about passenger rail issues here, including the issues that have come across the nation about safety on the rail. We have with us today Steve Coxhead. He's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. Steve, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Yes, good morning, Chris. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you're welcome. And we talk about the problems with rail safety. We know that there's been ongoing work on positive ways to be able to deal with problems on the rail, but we still have train accidents, and latest particular we know about, of course, the one that happened close to Washington, D.C., and one in South Carolina, too. Bring us up to date from what you know here about the investigation and how all of these problems on the rails seem to be affecting passenger rail, even for us here in Northwest Indiana.
Right. It is a problem. I mean, we've had a series of problems. And I'll back up one step. The Amtrak derailment in, I believe it was Washington State, not too long ago. That was one incident. And then we have the case for the special train carrying Republican members of Congress to a retreat in Virginia, had a collision with a truck. And then we have the latest one in South Carolina where a switch was misset. And they come together, and it's interesting because these are all, they're all three different things. Two of them are kind of related. The incident in Washington State was clearly where the engineer took a curve too fast.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's something that some of the positive train control, PTC systems that have been talked about, could have possibly prevented. The incident with the train carrying the Republican congressman, that was something we see all too often up here in Northwest Indiana. A large vehicle, in this case a truck, disregarded the warnings or tried to beat the train. And, of course, the train always wins in that case. Probably nothing PTC could have done about that. Then the case in South Carolina where it appears that a CSX employee had left the switch that led from the main line to the siding containing the park freight train, it was left in the wrong position. That's also something that potentially a PTC system could have prevented because they're designed to keep two trains from being on the same piece of track at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, both the incident of South Carolina and the one in Washington State, many say, are really matters of training. Engineers and operating personnel are trained very rigorously in the section of track that they're operating over, where they have to slow down, where they can speed up, danger areas and so forth. And I know that there are very rigorous rules, for instance, about what crews will do with switches and parked trains and so forth, and that would apply to the South Carolina incident. So you have kind of a grab bag of things going on here. What further muddies the waters is that the South Carolina incident involved CSX railroad trackage, and as many of us know, CSX is going through a period of turmoil in which they are downsizing their operating staff significantly, as well as doing other things.
And that's affecting us here in Northwest Indiana too, isn't it? Because we're finding all these
right.
Delays that pop up on the Hoosier State, and I'm sure even too on the Cardinal lines for Amtrak.
Well, right, because virtually all the Hoosier State's track, which is CSX, and the Cardinal, as it wends its way from New York to Chicago, goes over a lot of CSX trackage, both in Indiana and further east. So that's an ongoing problem. And You know, so it's unfortunate that there doesn't seem to be a way that the public can be given, they can put many of these things in perspective and see the large picture, because I'm sure many people see, they just remember, you know, three blaring headlines about Amtrak problems. We forgot to mention the Acela problem that was sandwiched in there sometime around the time of the South Carolina incident, where an Acela train basically separated, going 80 or 90 miles an hour. And we have to remember those Acela trains, I think, were new 30 years ago. So we're working with very old equipment there. So, yeah, I mean, it is very important. The rails have had, in modern times, an excellent safety record, actually. If you compare it to highway fatalities or even airline fatalities, they really do a good job. However, we're seeing problems, and if you look at the context, some of these problems could be due to the chaotic situation that, for instance, Amtrak is in because of, for one thing, uncertainty about their finances.
That's right. Yeah, we know the Trump administration's planning some infrastructure changes, would like to get something done, but very little, if anything, has been put in for rail at all.
Right, and we have no federal budget yet. You know, Congress and the White House have not gotten together and gotten the budget passed, so we really don't know what's going to happen. Yeah, you're right. There's been no specific mention of rail, you know, in the Trump initiative, although earlier during the campaigning season, you know, he said some things about bringing our rail up to par with the Chinese high-speed rail system, but we haven't heard too much about that lately. And, of course, with no budget, Amtrak doesn't know what its financing is going to be, and so that impacts practically everything. Even the Hoosier State, because you know that ties in with the Amtrak, you know, interstate system. I know that there have been the legislation that has come out of committee that regards transportation and Amtrak. It generally has seemed favorable. The congressmen as a whole don't seem inclined to basically gut the Amtrak budget or the transportation budget, but that's still all in committee. Mm-hmm. Nothing has actually come to the floor of the House or Senate and had a vote taken. So we're all just up in the air waiting to see what happens. That affects a lot of things in Indiana. For instance, we have our colleagues over in Fort Wayne that are working diligently to get a service reestablished from Chicago through Fort Wayne onto Columbus, Ohio.
Right.
To move forward, that requires some federal funding, which has been applied for. Right now, we don't know what federal funding is going to be available, let alone what the criteria will be for claiming it. So that's stalled. The idea that that we don't really have a budget and things are up in the air has a lot of ramifications. And I would imagine our friends over in the highway and the airways sectors are having similar problems.
I would imagine
they don't know what's going to happen either.
That's true.
We
talked a little bit here about Amtrak earlier here in our conversation, in particular about CSX, and we mentioned and kind of alluded to the problems that that the Hoosier State Line has been facing with the CSX freight trains in the way, an awful lot of them, in turn delaying the departures and arrivals for the Hoosier State. What's the latest that you understand from the CSX people since they're getting short staffed by the day, it seems?
Yeah. CSX basically has been uncooperative since the advent of Hunter Harrison, and then his replacement, since he unfortunately passed away, is carrying on his work. That railroad is still in a turmoil, and they are still having problems with maintaining their schedules and moving their trains about in a safe and efficient manner, and so that continues to affect both the Hoosier State and the Cardinal through Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
The best word I have from the people I have access to is that CSX basically stopped talking, you know, to NDOT once Hunter Harrison took over. So I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen there. I know that the freight customers are still unhappy. There have been hearings before the Surface Transportation Board, but the STB has limited powers of enforcement. Everyone seems to be upset with the way the CSX is running its business these days.
I can tell that obviously the freight customers are not happy. Now, although here in Northwest Indiana, a lot of the lines that come through are Canadian National lines that come through with a lot of freight. But you notice too that even on the other tracks, that there seem to be time periods where there are a lot of freight trains running, and then there are days seemingly on end where there are no freight trains running. So that's got to drive the freight customers crazy. They want their shipments in. They want to get those trains moved.
Well, you know, yeah, and as in many things, it comes down to human factors. My understanding is that before the Hunter-Harrison era, that CSX and our Department of Transportation, for instance, were really engaging in a very productive dialogue that was getting things done. And then basically, at a point in time, CSX stopped talking to INDOT.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, this is not an official statement from INDOT, but it's what I have gleaned from, you know, talking with various conversations with various people.
Right.
You know, it's been pointed out that basically CSX is bigger than some parts of the federal government and certainly bigger than the state of Indiana. There's a real concern on the part of some of us as to whether or not what happens in Indiana is even of any concern to CSX. You know, including the trial balloon they've floated about selling off, you know, parts of their system. Well, you know, we don't know. Are they considering selling off the part that runs from Indianapolis up to Dyer here? And if they did that, well, then what happens to our train service?
Right.
So there's a lot of unknowns there. So far, I can say, so far there have not been any indications that CSX is close to resolving its internal problems, no indication that it's particularly interested in cooperating with Amtrak or the state of Indiana to run passenger trains. A lot of us are trying to figure out how long that situation has gone on. I know our organization has contacted every member of Indiana's congressional delegation, bringing with expressions of concern, bringing the situation to their attention and ask them to do what they can about it. It's just a very bad situation, and right now we can't see the end of it. And of course, how do you build usage on a rail passenger line if you can't guarantee it's going to stick to schedule?
Yeah, that's true. But speaking of schedule changes here, we ought to probably mention too, and this is not related to as much to the Cardinal and the Hoosier State, although they are affected, as it is to points to the east because of the service that leaves Indiana and goes off to the east and ends up going all the way to New York City. I guess there's some changes Amtrak has had to tell people about to be aware of here very soon because of some work that is going to happen at Penn Station in New York City.
Right. We received a notice that basically the Cardinals being truncated north of Washington, D.C. as of the end of this month, with no specific commitment or prediction as to when the service will return.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is important in a way because it's central Indiana's only direct rail link with New York City, as well as Washington. So it is of some concern to us. What is of concern is that Amtrak appears to have been very close-mouthed about this suspension of service. You know, I've been talking to people up and down the route of the Cardinal between here and the East Coast, and evidently not only have notices not gone up in stations, but in stations that are staffed, the operating personnel haven't been made aware of it either. So this has been kind of a stealth operation. And because of that, our organization is worried about Amtrak's ultimate intentions. There's been cases in the past where service has been discontinued or truncated for reasons that had to do with maintenance or repairs or temporary things, and yet it never really came back.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I can't sit here and tell you that's going to be the case here. On the other hand, because Amtrak hasn't projected when the service will be resumed, and because of the fact that they haven't been too public about spreading the word, we have concerns.
Do you think that maybe in this case here in particular, with the route ending just outside of Washington, D.C., as you say, at least for this particular period, they may have to work out some kind of alternate transportation like busing or something to be able to make the rest of the route end to New York City?
Well, the thing is, there are like 9 or 10 trains a day between mm-hmm. Washington and New York, okay? These coasts are very well served.
Right.
It's sort of like the South Shore between Chicago and Michigan City. Mm-hmm. There are many trains. So certainly you could take, for instance, the Cardinal to D.C., and then you'd have to change trains and then go on to Philadelphia or New York City. Okay, not a disaster, but the thing is, you have to change trains. You know, I know all of us have been frustrated, for instance, when we've flown someplace. You know, you want to fly between City A and City B, which you think is a relatively short hop, but yet you have to go through a hub and you have to change planes, and then if there's a problem, you miss connections and so forth and so forth. Well, you have the same thing in rail travel. You know, if you know that you're going to get on the train in Indianapolis and you can get off it in New York, that's one thing. If you know that you're going to get on the train in Indianapolis and you're going to have to get off it in D.C., and then you're going to have to change to another train and then continue, you know, that's another matter entirely.
Yeah.
Like I say, it's not a catastrophe, but it's an indication, you know, possibly of things going the wrong way. We have a couple trains going from Chicago to New York and to D.C., which are also options, but...
Well, we'll just have to see because, yeah, at the very least, it's going to be an inconvenience. It's a planned inconvenience if you know, like, if you're making the train route from Indiana to Washington, D.C., and then catching the train to go south to Florida, that's one thing. And you know about that, and you know that you have to kind of plan for that. But then you don't, here in this case, you don't know what's going to happen for the surface. You know you'll have to change over someplace outside Washington, D.C., or at Washington, D.C., I suppose, to be able to make the rest of the route. It's not what you want to have planned, and it's certainly not very good if you want to make a nice spring vacation out of riding the rail, so to speak.
Right. I mean, it's all the same problems you have as you transfer planes if you're flying someplace. You know, you have to worry about, is your luggage going to get transferred? If I'm late, what can I do about connections and so forth?
Well, Steve, we'll have to leave it at that. We really appreciate you taking time to talk about some of the issues with the rail safety and some of the other problems along the line for passenger rail customers. We've been talking with Steve Coxhead. He's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance, and we do appreciate you taking time to be with us to bring us up to date on some of these things, and we'll have you back on again to get kind of an update here as the travel season continues on.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and it's time once again for another edition of Green Fleet Radio. And here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. And today our guests are Mr. Matt Schilbowski. He's the Director of Central Services for the City of South Bend. And Mr. Jeff Hudek, he's the Director of Equipment Services for the City of South Bend. And gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl. And it's always nice for you to have us back to your program.
We love having you on. So first, congratulations on being named the 2017 South Shore Clean Cities MACOG Green Fleet Member of the Year at our annual meeting in February. Thank you and congratulations.
Thanks again, Carl. It's always nice to be recognized for our efforts in what we call greening the fleet by replacing liquid fuel vehicles with our alternate fueled vehicles, hybrids, or electric cars. But the real winners in this are our citizens. They get a cleaner environment throughout the city. So in purchasing those vehicles that we have purchased are going to be around for many, many years, emitting less emissions. And that's who really benefits our citizens with cleaner air.
Let's talk about some of the things that you've done to earn MACOG Green Fleet Member of the Year. Can you share with our listeners some of the success that South Bend has had in reducing some of your greenhouse gas emissions also?
Sure, Carl. Currently, we have about 218 vehicles, or 25% of our fleet, that are either hybrid, CNG, or electric-powered. And last year, these vehicles reduced our liquid fuel consumption by 175,000 gallons, which also resulted in a reduced greenhouse gases of 1,600 metric tons. And so we feel that's not only a success for South Bend, that's a success for the whole community.
Absolutely. You know, and I remember, you know, we've met and we've had you on different programs. And how did the city of South Bend actually build its fleet to include all these alternative fuel vehicles? I know it didn't start overnight, but how did you actually start this process?
No, actually, it starts, you know, with support of our city administration. Mm-hmm. Certainly, they put together a program and they support the funding so that we can continue to purchase alternate fuel vehicles. About 5 years ago, we started, and it started with a grant from Dieselwise, from IDEM, mm-hmm. Which has allowed us to purchase our first three CNG-powered refuse trucks and a slow-fill compressor. Seeing the value in that, the city of South Bend partnered with our local transportation company, Transpo, and we built a fast fill station. This is really where we got started, because in order to fill all these vehicles, obviously you got to have the infrastructure to do so. So investing in that infrastructure, building a fast fill station, once that was built, we got to expand our fleet. And now we have several different types of vehicles, including pickup trucks and police cars. So mm-hmm. we went into gasoline, diesel, or powered vehicles also instead of just the diesel vehicles.
And so what obstacles did you encounter when making some of this change to compressed natural gas and alternative fuel vehicles?
Well, one of the obstacles is that getting some of our users to accept the change mm-hmm. to natural gas. And as with any change, you have those that are supportive and see the positives, and some of those that push back. Most of our departments and users have really embraced the alternate fuel technology, knowing it's good for the environment. And they understand that producing less greenhouse gases today will carry over to future generations. They get it, and they feel good about the fact they're helping reduce our pollution. And all in all, mostly it's been a positive experience.
Well, again, I think, you know, you are definitely one of the leaders in our state with compressed natural gas and across the country. And so what advice would you give our listeners when they're considering a move to compressed natural gas?
Well, first off, I think what you need to do is you need to go gather as much information mm-hmm. as you can. Being informed, because you're the one they're going to come to. You're going to have to answer the questions for folks. Speak with, visit people that are currently using CNG or other alternate fuels. Pick their brains. Ask a lot of questions. Get informed. Certainly you can contact South Shore Clean Cities. Carl, you have a whole lot of information out there, both about alternate fuel fuels and about alternate fueled vehicles. Then you need to go out, you apply for grants. There's federal grants, there's state, there's even local dollars available to help reduce your emissions. So take advantage of all those. It takes a lot of work, but it really pays off in the long run.
Well, you know, you talked about that, is that you what a resource you've been, not only to the city of South Bend, but to other fleets about helping on the education part. And I think that's really been a key to the success of Indiana, is folks like both of you, that you've been such a resource, not only to your local community, but to other fleet managers to educate them on some of those things. So I can't say that enough to both of you, is that thank you so much for making a difference. And I wish we had an award for that, because you two would win that award. So so what are some of your future plans for the city of South Bend in reducing some of these greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, I'm really excited about our future plans. Right now, like Jeff said, 25% of our fleet is alternate fueled or electric or a hybrid. Our plan is to get to 85%.
Okay.
That's our ultimate goal. It's going to take a few more years than we thought, but we're working in that direction. And we do have, like I said, the administrative support to do that. We're currently working on an idle reduction policy, which will cover all city vehicles. We will be installing our first electric charging station here in the next couple weeks in downtown South Bend, very close to our county city building. And I'm excited to say that in the next couple of months, we're going to get a few announcements coming out, I think, from the city administration that's going to be very helpful to us reducing our carbon footprint. So I think there's some exciting things coming to South Bend.
Well, there's always exciting things working with both of you and working with the city of South Bend, and we're really proud of all your accomplishments. So how can people learn more about the city of South Bend and some of the green things that you're doing?
Well, certainly you can go to the city webpage. There's some things in there about our fleet and the size of fleet. You can certainly contact Jeff Hudak at our office, or myself at our office at the Central Services Division for the City of South Bend. And certainly get a hold of us. We're free to meet with you. Either we can talk with you on the phone. We're glad to have you out and show you around the city, where our fueling stations look like, what the vehicles look like. And we're always wanting to share our information that we've gained so that you can become more informed.
Matt and Jeff, as always, thank you again for being on the show. Thanks for all you do for the environment. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Matt Chabowski, Director of Central Services for the City of South Bend, and Mr. Jeff Hudak, Director of Equipment Services for the City of South Bend. Remember, Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Thank you, Carl. You can always hear the conversations from Green Fleet Radio on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and just look at that. Or you can also catch it, too, if you have your smartphone handy, to go on the NPR One app and just go to WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. A unique Indiana bed and breakfast has been added to Booking.com's ultimate Book the U.S. list. And the website has set this up very nicely. And interestingly enough, this bed and breakfast is located here in Northwest Indiana, in fact, in Southlake County. With us to talk about it, we have Shane Moody, who is with Booking.com. And Shane, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me on. Good afternoon to you. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, if you will take a moment, explain what Booking.com is all about and how this Book the U.S. list got created.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, Booking.com is our mission to empower people to experience the world. We are the global leader in connecting travelers to the widest choice of incredible places to stay. So we're currently inspiring travelers to find and book the most incredible accommodations across the U.S. with our newly launched Book the U.S. list. Mm-hmm. That was curated by experts at Booking.com and features the coolest, most unique properties across all of the U.S., ranging from options like landmarks to caves in New Mexico, castles in Kentucky, tree houses in Ohio, and more. It's only fitting if property is spectacular as Time for Bed in Indiana made the list.
We'll talk in more detail here about this place here, which is located not far from Lowell in Southlake County. But in Illinois, even the house that's unique there, the bed and breakfast, is set up in a what used to be a Frank Lloyd Wright home.
Correct. Yeah. So outside of Chicago, we have a Frank Lloyd Wright home, and it's a beautiful property itself. And it's a great example of the many unique properties that we have featured on this list for travelers to go experience.
Now, since you have probably so many opportunities to choose from to be able to put locations on this list, how did you come up with the one that we have here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, absolutely. Good question. So we really worked with our local teams and some experts in booking to come up with the most unique destinations and unique experiences for our travelers. One-third of all travelers globally have shared with us, based on our research, that they're looking for a unique experience, a unique place to stay. So we really looked across the U.S. to find these unique ones. And I would say Time for Bed is one of those, a monolithic dome that built in 99 that was fireproof, concrete, steel shell that could sustain winds to 300 miles per hour. And that's over in beautiful rolling countryside of Lowell, Indiana, where guests can enjoy bird watching, fishing, hiking trails, horseback riding, and just a quick 10-minute drive from historic downtown Lowell. So we think this one fits the bill as far as being unique and a great place to experience.
As we mentioned here, this location is in Southlake County. It's, as you mentioned, it's called Time. That is spelled the same as the herb, T-H-Y-M-E, Time for Bed Dome. It is a monolithic dome that's out there. In fact, it's located on West 185th Avenue in Lowell, so it's easy to get to from the area highways and to go out there, but still far enough away, I'm sure, for a very, very nice stay or a week, I guess, a weekend, if you want to make a weekend out of it as well, too. Describe this place, if you will, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's owned by Crystal and William Britzman, and they built this place in 1999, and it's something to definitely foresee, so I encourage your listeners to go on to Booking and check it out. It's an amazing place, and the service there is even more incredible based on the guest reviews that we have. But yeah, essentially, what we're saying, it's a monolithic dome. It is actually a dome, and it has several bedrooms, a see-through fireplace, a jacuzzi inside of it. And it's always safe and secure to know that it could survive 300-mile-an-hour winds. So I guess it's a place to run to if you have a local storm going through as well. But based on reviews, it is an incredible place to experience and check out with the great host from Crystal and William Britzman.
This is an interesting dome. In fact, if you go on booking.com and you type in the time for bed dome, you'll get the chance to see a little gallery of pictures of what this place looks like on the inside. Very, very nice. And because it's out in the countryside here in Lake County, in South Lake County, how close is it to some of the area highways where folks may want to be able to stay for a while and then take off and go into the city, in Chicago even, and check out the sites?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, let's mention it's like a quick 10-minute drive from historic downtown Lowell, which features a lot of quaint cafes, boutiques, and small markets for travelers to go and experience the countryside and some of the downtown shopping and you know, eatery locations as well. So, and then you're only a short hour or so drive from Chicago as well, so a good chance to go to the city to experience other, like you mentioned, Frank Lloyd Wright's Emerald Bauhaus. Or if you want to travel to neighboring states, you could go and experience the tree house in Ohio. We have a mushroom house in Michigan that looks like a home that's straight from the Shire from Lord of the Rings, and it's a really cool style. But we also have a castle in Kentucky if you want to drive down to Kentucky to experience that as well. So some really great, unique properties to experience.
Now, if you check out the listing that's on booking.com and look into this particular location there in Lowell, you'll get some reviews from people. What kind of reviews have you received from travelers and people who have stayed at the Dome since it's been on the list?
Oh, thank you for asking. Yeah, we have some great reviews, very highly reviewed. People pretty much say it's an amazing gem. And they really enjoy the unique experience of staying there. But more than that, it's the hospitality that they get from Crystal and William from staying there, from good food, good service, and just warm hospitality. And like you mentioned before, it's a unique place. They even say they have a gaggle of pheasants where you could actually go outside, sit out there, watch pheasants and other birds, and then get a chance to hike the trails and do a little bit of horseback riding while you're experiencing out there. So a little bit of peace. But yeah, the reviews speak to that, and very highly reviewed and recommended place to stay.
I took a look at one of the reviews that was listed with the heading as Hope to Return. So somebody must have stayed apparently for the night or maybe a day or two, and they're making a trip, I guess, on a business run, so to speak, and then they stopped by, made arrangements, and enjoyed staying overnight. And they got quite impressed, I guess, not only by the surroundings that they were in, but about the comfort of the B&B to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. You wouldn't think first thought of staying in a dome as being very comfortable. But that's exactly what the reviewers say, is they really enjoy the uniqueness of the experience, the countryside, as well as having some great hosts who own the property as well. So I think it's a great opportunity to experience in one of over 50 unique accommodations that we feature across the U.S. And definitely think people should check out Time for Bed as being top that list.
Well, just go on to booking.com and you can type the information in. Go to the ultimate Book the U.S. list. You'll find you'll find that great dome that's located in South Lake County, just outside of Lowell there. Shane Moody is with the website, booking.com. And Shane, thank you for spending time to tell us more about this Time for Bed dome and why it's worth checking out on the website and maybe even making reservations to stay there. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much, and safe travels, and have a great day.
It's the time of year when Ravinia Festival announces their lineup for the season. And Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke recently with the president and CEO, Wells Kaufman, about the big plans, the debuts, and the celebrations that are on deck for the summer of 2018. Now, Sharon's been talking with Kaufman so often that it seems like they're old friends when they're chatting on the phone, and well, maybe they are. Well, in any case, here's the conversation.
Everybody that I've talked to at Ravinia last year who was there having a good time, they all had such positive things to say.
That's great.
They love the talent that was there. The shows that I went to, you got a huge turnout for them. So congratulations on your continued success.
Well, knock wood, right? And hope that can continue.
Oh, totally.
You never know. But
yeah.
Man, is it a fun place to work. As I've told you before, I'm just the luckiest guy in the world. Such a beautiful place, such a great staff, such a marvelous audience who are adventurous and hungry for new things, and they want the standard things, and they want the traditional things, and, you know, but they're willing to take a chance, whether it's on a pop artist they've never heard of, or a classical piece they've never heard, or whatever it might be. It's pretty cool.
It's nice that you have such a like a variety. You appeal to like all tastes.
Yeah.
I was really impressed with last year was, you know, lead singer Switchfoot did like a street show outside of the gates. That was really cool. I'd never experienced anything like that before. So Yeah, what you got going on this year?
Well, there's a lot of wonderful stuff, a lot of artists who I've been trying to get for a long time, which we'll talk about. But first and foremost, this is the centennial year of the most important classical musician America's ever produced and probably ever will produce in our time, and maybe that the world's ever known, Leonard Bernstein. And not only because of his extraordinary output as a composer, you know, from West Side Story to his three symphonies to the Serenade for violin, which is basically a violin concerto, all the songs, et cetera, et cetera. He also was a great pianist, an amazing conductor who rediscovered or renewed a lot of standard work and unknown work for the classical canon. He was America's music teacher, no question about that. When you think about a 10-plus year run of primetime television about classical music, I mean, we can't even conceive of that today. But to be on CBS every night at 8 o'clock, not every week at 8 o'clock, I mean, it's just kind of astonishing. But of course, that was his charisma, that was his passion, that was his huge brain, and teaching was hugely important to him. So when I say America's music teacher, I really mean that. So many people I know, including kids today, who are watching the young people's concerts that were televised, they're watching them on the internet, on the websites that are available, on even on VCR sort of machines, old stuff, really staggering. And then the last piece, the sort of fifth facet of this extraordinary man, was his social humanitarian bent, his social equality focus, someone who put quite deliberately and very controversially African-Americans into his shows in the 40s with white and black people dancing together in On the Town. Doesn't seem radical at all today, but at the time, hugely so. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover had a 1,000-page FBI file on Bernstein. That's I don't know if that's a badge of honor or a mark of disgrace for our country, but this was hugely important to him, and especially later in life, as he did so much work around AIDS, as he was always bisexual. So sort of soup to nuts in terms of that, anti-Vietnam War. I'm playing a little concert of his vocal music with a young lady who was an alum of our vocal program here, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary. This thing did another big milestone.
Oh, what's the name of that vocal program?
It's the Ravinia Staines Music Institute. So it's our piano and strings, jazz, and singers programs that started with piano and strings 30 years ago, and then we added voice and jazz after that. Lots of exciting things happening in all of that arena. Lots of free performances, some commissions. We have a competition in the jazz arena that I'm really excited about. And then there are just so many alums who are playing quote-unquote regular concerts within the confines of the festival who've become big stars. So we're very proud of that and want to show that off. There are great programs like this at Tanglewood and at Aspen and at Interlaken, but the Ravinia program, which is the youngest of all of those, is going great guns. And Bernstein would have loved it. He tried to start his own program like that at the Hollywood Bowl back in the 80s, and it never really took off for a variety of reasons that are silly to go into. But this extraordinary man who are celebrating through the curatorship of a wonderful conductor named Marin Alsop, a few female conductors out there today, and his last protege, and only female protege. So she's helped me for the last 4 years put together this summer from a standpoint of classical music, both the Chicago Symphony and our smaller theater, chamber music and recital offering. Just a lot of really cool stuff. And as I say, I mean, so many of us who work in this business were inspired by him, but it's every facet of this extraordinary human being that we want to celebrate. And we'll probably do it over several years. There's too much to do in the constraints of one summer, and there's so much to celebrate. And in a lot of ways, Sharon, he's kind of a mirror for what we are musically, because he was a, you know, acclaimed Broadway composer. He wrote pop songs. He loved the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel, talked about that all the time. He was the teaching part, which is a huge part of the Ravinia mantra and philosophy. It's so interesting to hold him up and say, yeah, we do that. But I'm not sure we would have been doing it, quite frankly, without his power and his celebrity. Think of a conductor today who would have been hobnobbing with, you know, Paul McCartney and the Kennedys and the Black Panthers. And this was quite a force. He did an anti-Vietnam concert with a whole huge list of stars, he and Paul Newman. This is in the late 60s, Paul Newman, he co-hosted it, and he wrote a song for Barbara Streisand, who sang it. And that kind of thing, which kind of gives me goosebumps and makes me feel like, where did all that go? Because we don't have that today. We've got wonderful conductors. We've got the greatest musicians in the world around us, but not that kind of phenomenon. So, as I say, we want to dig deep into all of that greatness. And, of course, the music is the place to begin.
Is Ravinia, I should say, having a concert for him or several?
Ooh, lots of concerts. Lots and lots of concerts. So, great question. So, at our Staines Music Institute, the vocalist will be doing all of his songs over a couple of concerts. We're doing his gigantic music theater piece called Mass, which Jackie Onassis commissioned to open the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. in the early 70s. That's really the mega event. Hundreds of people on stage, Chicago Symphony, rock musicians, rock singers, classical singers, full concert choir, children's choir. It's just a really astonishing piece that many people thought was a bit of a mess, more than a mass, when it opened, and now it's largely believed to be his masterwork. We're doing his Serenade, his first symphony, Jeremiah, and then we're doing work by composers that, without Lenny, I don't think we would have today in the way that we do. Mahler being at the top of the list, but also Shostakovich and Stravinsky, Aaron Copland's music, people that he was great friends with, people whose music he loved, people who he thought were great teachers, and then the kind of forgotten works of Mahler. It's hard to believe when he started doing all the symphonies in the 50s and 60s that they really weren't being done that often. And now they're a regular part of what we think of as the classical canon. So lots of good stuff going on. His daughter, he has three kids who are with us, and his eldest daughter is coming to do a program of anecdotes and music in Bennett Gordon Hall for us, and she'll do some talks as well. She's also going to narrate her own young people's concert, all using her dad's music, which has not been done before. It's exciting. That's in July, sort of mid-season. So lots of cool things.
Amazing, the social awareness that Leonard Bernstein had. I was a little ignorant to that. I did not know that.
Many people don't, and there's good reason. You know, when someone is a celebrity conductor, but also, as you know, in the classical world, it's such a world of kind of rarefied air and, dare I say, arrogance and elitism, sort of ivory towerishness. And he was criticized for writing beautiful music, writing tonal music. This is the 50s, 60s, 70s when everything was difficult and everything was 12-tone and everything was dissonant. But he stuck to his guns, not only with his own output, but also with his other American composer friends and Europeans. But the social piece, hugely important. I mean, like I said, I'm playing this song. It's called So Pretty, that was written specifically for Streisand and then for Lenny to play for her at an anti-Vietnam War benefit. It was actually a benefit to raise money for congressional candidates who were anti-Vietnam War. And that's why they had all these superstars. It was done at Lincoln Center in the 60s. And the song is absolutely stunning. And I'd not only had not heard it, I'd never heard of it until 2 weeks ago. So it's exciting to discover something new and fresh that you didn't know anything about from someone who's had such a gigantic impact. And I really want to make sure that the whole world is celebrating him. That's his fame, that's his power, that's his legacy. But I really want to do a lot of it at Ravinia, especially for kids, because I'm not sure in my lifetime we'll see another sort of superstar, you know, firecracker like this career and this impact. It's sad to say that, but you just never know. So let's take advantage of the moment, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all those things made him very special. Do you think he was such a superstar because of his musical talent and because of his social awareness and what he did, like an activism sort of thing? Or
I think it was all of that. And because another thing that I think I lose sight of, and I should know better, is that he was the first great American conductor. All the conductors were European, all of them. That kind of makes sense. You know, if you think of the classical music canon, it's European music, right? It's Bach and Beethoven and Ravel and Debussy and Shostakovich and Mozart, Rachmaninoff. So that makes sense. So here's this guy who at 25 years old makes his unexpected New York Philharmonic debut and just takes off like crazy, all unbelievably thrilling. And I think the excitement around that then, and he's a good self-promoter as well, handsome. You know, all of that figures in. One can't discount those pieces of someone's fame, whether it's a movie star or a politician or a musician or a visual artist or a sculptor. All of that is relevant. It's just that we've never had anybody like that before, and we haven't seen anybody like that since, except perhaps in his young years, because he's in his 30s, you've probably heard of a conductor in Los Angeles named Gustavo Dudamel.
Well, I heard of him from you last year, and I learned about him through you.
Him, right?
Yeah.
Because the government of Venezuela canceled the tour that he was taking with his kids. Well, he's going to make his Chicago Symphony Orchestra debut at Ravinia this summer. He's conducted the CSO before, but never at Ravinia. So it feels kind of perfectly aligned that, you know, Bernstein Centennial, even though we're going to celebrate many over a couple of years, but this is the actual year that Dudamel would be coming to us for the first time. Just thrilling. I overweight the impact and the significance of that, but I do believe that the stars align for a reason, you know. And Gustavo is, I mean, this is charisma like crazy. I just heard him do the piece Mass that I was just describing to you that we're going to do this summer. He did that in L.A., and it was just phenomenal. And he's a nice guy, and he's writing music for Hollywood, and his wife's an actress, and he's the basis for that, I think it's a Netflix show, maybe Amazon show called Mozart in the Jungle. He's the model for the conductor in that, and it's interesting to see that it's not an American, but it's a Venezuelan, a Latin American. So Gustavo is also big on the teaching part because he comes out of the Sistema programs out of Venezuela. He's the superstar person, though there are other musicians who are coming out of that now. It's been going on for 40 years, a program that was all about social justice and taking kids off the dangerous streets of Caracas, putting instruments in their hands and having them sing. Extraordinary thing like what were done in the civil rights movement in the U.S., certainly in Chicago, the Chicago Children's Choir. It wasn't meant to be a choir, but it is, of course, a wonderful musical organization, but it was really about putting black and white kids together at a challenging time in America. So I love all this stuff. I love the music. There's no question about that. And music is pure and stands on its own, and one can look at it, you know, in the clear light of day and enjoy it for what it is. But I do think the background of someone like a Bernstein might attract, instill in somebody who might not have looked at classical music to take a look. You just never know what's going to hit people.
Now, you answered my question before I was going to even ask it about Gustavo Dudamel. You know, he came up through the Sistema program out of Venezuela, and you told me that last year. Yeah, because he was supposed to come last year, so got canceled.
He was doing a tour with the National Youth Orchestra of Venezuela, and the president of Venezuela and Maestro Dudamel got into a little bit of a contretemps because the president of Venezuela was really cracking down on the people of Venezuela. At least that was Gustavo's take. I'm not a Venezuelan. I've never been there. I don't really know, but that was the situation. So Maduro, the president, canceled the tour. He was supposed to go to Wolf Trap in Berkeley and the Hollywood Bowl into us. And so sadly it didn't happen. But we're thrilled to have him with the Chicago Symphony and the hugely remarkable pianist, Yuta Wang, who the Sting's alum, our summer conservatory, is super exciting pianist. And the two of them together, I've seen them do Bartok and Rachmaninoff and all sorts of things. It's really an event. That's an old Beethoven program coming up.
Just as a quick side note, what happened in Venezuela that has allowed him now to come here? Do you know?
Well, he doesn't actually live in Venezuela anymore, so he lives in Los Angeles. I think he might have another outpost in Berlin or London. And I'm sure there's a home in Caracas still. But it wasn't so much that he wasn't allowed to leave, it was his student kids who made up the orchestra that was supposed to tour last summer. They were not allowed to leave. Plus, we were getting worried that Trump, Mike Pence, went to Venezuela and said that we were going to attack them. You know, crazy talk. You know, who attacks Venezuela? It's not what you do in a diplomatic situation, a political situation. Nevertheless, that came up, and that really angered the Venezuelans. I can understand why. And so we thought maybe, if this orchestra is allowed to leave Venezuela, you know, might they find themselves in a precarious position politically? Might they be used as a kind of political football, you know, between the U.S. government and the Venezuelan government? So it may have been a blessing, as disappointing as it was, that they were unable to travel. And they'll come some other time.
You guys do the Sistema program, the Ravinia Sistema program. That's still going on?
Absolutely. Growing all the time. So we're hoping to start New Nucleos. It's basically the name for site where one does this work. So we have one in the Austin neighborhood. We have one here at Ravinia. We're hoping to open one up in Lawndale. And the sky's kind of the limit because it not only is a great way to bring music to kids, it's a great way to bring their parents to it as well, right? Because they're dropping them off for rehearsals and really engaged in something that is so intense. Marin Alsop, our curator for the Bernstein Summit this summer, she does a huge system of program herself at the Baltimore Symphony, where she's the music director. So it's kind of all nicely connected.
Very cool.
Yeah, no, exactly. It is cool. I mean, only because we had no idea the impact and the fast impact that it would have. We knew the summit was a wonderful thing to be doing. Time intensive, expensive, and all very well worth it. We just didn't know how quickly it would take off here. And of course, we've got these beautiful facilities, many of which are not well used in the wintertime, right? So it's great to have these facilities used by kids. And I love the fact that kids come and play in our halls because, you know, you can play in your music room at your school or your multipurpose room at your school. It's not the same as playing in a professional theater. And there's a ramping up of excitement and desire to do well that comes with that environment.
What else did you want to mention in terms of what you guys got planned for this year?
The Means 30th and the Bernstein 100th are big. We've kind of covered the waterfront on those, which is great. It's just that you and I had discussed those in pretty good detail. So moving on from Bernstein and Stange for the moment, I really would like to point out a piece called Considering Matthew Shepard. 2018 is the 20th anniversary of the murder of Matthew Shepard in Laramie, Wyoming. And of course, he became a martyr within the gay rights movement. Hideous situation all the way around. Wonderful group out of Texas, Choral Instrumental, have created a piece called Considering Matthew Shepard. We'll be doing the Chicago premiere of that piece in September. We also have the Los Angeles Master Chorale coming to do a Renaissance masterwork, the Italian of which I cannot repeat because I'll mangle it, but it's in English, Tears of St. Peter's. Absolutely glorious piece. That's also going to be in September. And then we have the debut of Sugarland, a band I've been trying to get here for a long time. We have the debut of Jason Mraz, a singer I've been trying to get here for a long time. We've got concert performances of The Who's Tommy with Roger Daltrey, which we've already announced, but very exciting to have an icon of rock and roll like that and in that particular work. Plus, greatest hits of The Who on that same performance, two performances of that. We're doing a 50th anniversary of Jethro Tull, always a perennial favorite at Ravinia. Miss Diana Ross coming back to us after her debut a couple of summers ago. Angelique Kidjo, one of my favorite singers, she's coming with Femi Kuti. Lots of great chamber music concerts, lots of low-priced classical concerts, $10, $25 to enjoy the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. There's so much, Sharon, I'm sorry. I'm kind of bouncing around here in terms of how the season gets laid out. Pretty exciting, yeah. Yeah. Oh, Whoopi Goldberg in her debut at Ravinia. So a comedy evening with her. I'm very excited about that. I've been working on that for a long time as well. Lots of great Baroque music. I'm an astonishingly gifted guitarist named Milos, who was with us a couple of years ago. He's coming back to play a recital in the Martin Theater. Do you know Lindsay Sterling?
No, I don't.
So Lindsay is a super gifted violinist who does kind of rock and roll violin and mashups as well. She's going to be with the band Evanescence. They're collaborating together with an orchestra.
That's
going to be the debut for both of those at Ravinia. Very excited about that. Jill Scott coming for the first time. Alison Krauss is coming back. Jackson Brown's coming back. Emerson String Quartet. Audra McDonald is our gala soloist with the Chicago Symphony. Lots of fun stuff. Lots of summertime stuff. Lots of super serious things like the Bernstein Centennial in general and the Matthew Shepard piece. But as you said earlier, you know, something for everyone. That's what we really try for.
Thank you so much, Wells.
A pleasure to talk to you always. Take care, Sharon.
And you can always go on the Ravinia Festival website and check out the artists and the tickets and get those tickets available now. They're on sale today. That's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with us tomorrow, we hope, because it's Roundtable Reporter Roundtable Thursday. That means we'll have Meredith Colius-Pete and Carol Carlson and Carrie Napoleon all from the Post-Tribune with us.